Boom, what up? Hello, bonjour, and hola, real leaders. This is Kevin Edwards, your host here, and I am so excited you're tuning in to one of our amazing experiences. What you're about to hear is going to be fresh, real, and loaded with inspiration, guaranteed to support your impact journey. So sit back, enjoy the listen, folks, share a review afterward, and always keep it real. 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Welcome, everyone, to this episode of the Real Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Edwards. And alongside me today, folks, halfway across the world, 16 hours, right? 16 hours. We've got Johan Rosali Watuth, the founder and CEO of Binteng Capital Partners. Johan, thanks for being with me today.
Kevin, a real pleasure to be with you.
Course. So I have to maybe just mention this first. The first time I saw Binteng Capital Partners, got to be honest, I thought of Bali, Indonesia, and I thought of Binteng the beer. And I was getting really excited there, but I take it no correlation with you then, huh?
Nope.
Oh, man. That's too bad. But hey, at the end of the day, we're both having an impact, right? So I just was always curious about that. But Binteng Capital Partners, I was excited to see that the investments are solely focused on impact. Now, private equity and impact, you know, when you say that in a sentence, it makes one kind of scratch their heads. Private equity and impact. And so where I'd like to really start, Johan, is really back to your origin story. You know, how someone with this financial background fell into this space. When I ask you that question, what resonates with you?
Yeah, I think, a lot of people don't realize that the journey of private equity into impact isn't altogether a new one. You've got some great examples from US and the European part of the world where, you've got players like TPG who created Rise. That happened in, I think it was 2015, 2016, where they collaborated with Bono from U2. You've got KKR who have an impact arm called KKR Impact. And they've been really doing this business for probably about a decade now. Yeah, so I think the private equity movement and impact have started to coalesce. And I think there's more and more awareness, I think, within the private equity space that impact is important. I have a very similar origin story, actually, to the transition, I guess, between private equity and impact. I worked in conventional alternative investing in London for about a decade before I moved back to Malaysia in 2010. To be very honest with you, I fell in love with the world of private equity and really what's there not to love. You work with inspirational, really innovative founders, who've got a great vision. You're working with management teams who are very capable. You're looking at companies that tend to be disruptors in their industries. And at the same time, there's so much variety because you're not pigeonholed and you're not just looking at one industry, you're looking at four or five different industries, right? So it's a lot of fun. But I think the thing that really struck me about the way that private equity was done in a conventional sense was that, when you look at numbers on a spreadsheet, you're not really realizing the human cost of a lot of those numbers. And, before I went into the world of private equity, I was working in corporate restructuring and I had to face things like people being let go from their jobs. And I was the person talking to these guys who were being let go from their jobs. And at that juncture, I guess I realized that behind every number on a spreadsheet, there was a story, there was a family, there was a human life. So when the opportunity came, I guess, for us to form Binteng, which happened about 6 years ago, I thought to myself, there has to be a better way of doing private equity. And I felt that as an industry, as a whole, we have to evolve, I think, to take societal and environmental considerations, I think, into account more than the industry already was at that point in time. So, I think many of the team at Binteng have quite similar stories as I do about how they ended up in this space. I think they came to a realization at some stage in their life, in their career, that there's got to be a way to make lives better, actually, through the work that we do in the finance industry. And, you know, we've been really lucky to have shareholders and investors who also believe in this philosophy of ours, and they're prepared to back us. So, you know, that in a nutshell, I guess, is how I came into impact, but also how the firm started its genesis into impact investing in private equity.
Well, thanks for sharing. And if I'm hearing you right, too, you know, an impact that it may have had on you is, you know, what are the additional costs that a business is having on society if they do let go someone? You know, at the end of the day, a private equity firm acquires its management coming in and saying, okay, well, we got to cut the fat here. It's the easiest way to cut our costs, increase our margins. And we really think about that. And so is there a solution that you've come across? And how has your acquisition strategy or strategy, investment strategy changed because of this?
Yeah, you know, I think efficiency is a good thing. I don't think we're coming from a proposition where we want businesses to be inefficient. So, you know, I think a lot of the confusion around impact and investing is whether that leads to inefficiency, right? But I think one key thing that a key concept, I guess, in impact investing is around sustainability and the fact that a business has to be long-term sustainable, right? And I think there are lots of components around building long-term sustainability into a business. And that includes looking at the general welfare of the people that work for your business, for instance, right? So, you know, I don't have an issue at looking at inefficiency or, you know, taking a closer look at efficiency in a business which is very clearly inefficient. You know, you mentioned trimming the fat, right? So a company where maybe you know, it's teetering on the edge of survivability because it's just become so inefficient over such a long time. But I think where I think the focus on inefficiency becomes inequitable is where that the benefits of that efficiency or efficiency gains in a business really trickle up to a very, very small group of people, right? So what do I mean by that? You know, when I used to look at businesses that we'd invested in the UK, when we look at inefficiency, one thing that really struck me about how we focus on inefficiency is the fact that we were never trimming people in the C-suite. You know, the guys who went to all the right schools, had all the great connections, were sitting right at the top of the food chain, the corporate food chain. We were never looking at that group and saying, hey, you know, we gotta lose 20% of these guys, right? But we would look at the guys on whose sweat, blood, and tears the business was built on. Right, the rank and file men and women who built the business in the first place. Right, now I just felt that there was a huge inequity in that mindset. So of course, when you trim, you know, the guys at the bottom of the pecking order, and the business makes more money, then you start asking, where does that extra money go? Where does that extra wealth go? Unsurprisingly, it goes to that top 10% in the business, and I just felt that that wasn't right. Right now, it gets worse because as allocators of capital, the private equity firms making the investments, they're the ones that get the lion's share of that equity creation that happens in the business, right? And, you know, I wouldn't, I guess, have so much of an issue with that if a lot of the guys who were making that money were saying, okay, you know, I've now made this huge amount of money. How can I create more societal impact with that capital, right? How can I change the world and improve standards of living for the better or change the environment for the better with all this wealth that's been created? Conversations were never about that, really, very rarely about that, I would say. I mean, there were some conversations around it, but they were far and few between. I think most of the conversations were about accumulating wealth for the sake of accumulating wealth. It was a very selfish accumulation of wealth. And, you know, I didn't see societal benefit from that accumulation of wealth. And I think that's where, you know, the mindset in private equity needs to change, right? We're not saying build more inefficient companies. We're not saying leave inefficient companies to be. But I think when efficiency is created, it's very important that we understand where the benefits of those efficiencies need to accrue within society.
It really seems like the conversation needs to be more focused on a sustainable long-term success equation as opposed to a short-term maximization success equation that's currently there. If I'm hearing that right, If that's the case, where in the financial structure do you view the companies that you invest in to be different?
Well, I think the very nature of private equity being more patient sources of capital, where we can sit on an investment for a multi-year period. There's a lot of flexibility around the allocation of that capital and the expectations of the capital being returned by LPs. I think that gives us very naturally a longer term mindset. But it is a little bit shocking, I think, around the realization that you make when you think about private equity having this quite short term mindset, in terms of creating returns very rapidly without any consideration for the cost, right? So if the question is around time horizons in terms of being able to hold investments, I don't think there's a mismatch. I think there is probably an application mismatch in the way that capital is being applied. I think the other major sort of misconception around private equity is the fact that impact would diminish returns. So you'd have this dynamic trade-off of if you make a impact investment or build a company towards impact, you would somehow need to sacrifice a bit of your IRR or your MOIC, right? My personal view is that this is again where probably buyers' mindsets towards businesses is changing. We've seen this global movement towards ESG investing more broadly, more narrowly within impact investing as well. The capital flows into ESG investing, I think now are sort of like $40 trillion globally. It's a huge amount of capital across all asset classes. And then within impact investing specifically, it's about, $2-3 trillion. So it's quite a sizable pool of capital. And I think where the industry hasn't caught on yet is that that pool of capital is only going to grow. It's moving in one direction, right? So it's a case of you either get on the train or get run over by the train. I think it's going mainstream. And ultimately, I think the deployers of these capitals, whether they are institutional money managers or corporate M&A guys, they're becoming a lot more sensitive to the downside risks of businesses that are not built with sustainability in mind. And they're also becoming increasingly cognizant of the upside opportunities as well for companies that are geared towards impact, right? So I think as that happens, the misconception around sacrificing returns and in the pursuit of impact strategies, I think will slowly start to diminish, probably go away in the next 5 to 10 years, right? There may be, in fact, quite the reverse happening where the expectations for people that invest in impact is that you'd be able to get a premium. You'd get a higher, risk-adjusted return. So the expectations would push GPs within the impact space to deliver higher returns, right? So I think that's the next frontier, the next challenge, I think, that GPs in this space are going to face.
And it could, right? I mean, we're seeing, obviously, some pushback right now with ESG, whether it's legislators in Tennessee filing suit, Texas, and this anti-ESG agenda, Larry Fink kind of pulling back a little bit, laying off some employees. But that's not to say that there aren't incredibly successful certified B Corp companies who are tying this impact not only into their communications, but into their operations and the leadership of the organization, which we quite really haven't seen in quite some time. I'm curious to learn, is there a specific industry that you focus on, a specific market size that you tend to kind of play in?
Now, we're pretty agnostic about the sectors that we invest in. So if you've gone to the website, you've seen that we've got a range of businesses that range from elder care, companies that provide elder care, landfill site and waste management businesses, very, very much in the traditional mold of impact, I would say. But we've also got businesses in the media space, businesses in retail, where there's an impact angle, but perhaps more of an indirect impact angle. So we're pretty agnostic. I think all industries possibly with very, very few exceptions. I mean, you know, the obvious ones that spring to mind are the businesses that are in the sin sectors, you know, businesses where inherently their business model is geared towards creating a larger carbon footprint. So the oil and gas space, probably, you know, those areas are off limits for us. It's very, very difficult for us, you know, to figure out how to create real sustainable long-term impact in those sectors. But generally, everything else is open season for us. You know, I think one of the things that we look for when we're trying to invest in a business is whether the essence of that business itself, as defined by the founder, creates impact by solving a major societal problem, right? So, you know, what we look for are companies that are very innovative in their way of solving that societal problem, right? So we call it the triple I strategy, or investing in impact and innovation. And really, for us, impact and innovation have to go hand in hand. They're two sides of the same coin. So, you know, why I think this is really important for us to understand is when an entrepreneur faces a societal problem and is trying to solve that societal problem, they build the business around solving that that problem. And how do they solve the problem? They innovate. So they build an innovative business that creates impact, where their reward by society is profit and ultimately equity value. So the mission, I guess, the goal for us is finding these founders and backing them. And I think something that's quite surprised us is, especially I would say amongst the Gen X and younger group of founders, there are quite a number of guys who are really driven by purpose. And you know, they're really powered by this fuel, this desire to build solutions to society's problem. And what we're trying to do as a GP is we're committed to institutionalizing these founders into an impact mindset and building that into the company's DNA. And how do we do that? You know, it's really through things like getting these companies B Corp certified. So, you know, that's something else I think that the team is very passionate about. We're trying to build 150 B Corp certified portfolio companies in Southeast Asia by 2050, right? So I think the final part of the equation is really our area of focus. We're a small firm. We're just starting in this journey. You know, so we're very, very focused on the Southeast Asian region. Really the core markets for us are Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, and Vietnam. These are markets that we are a little bit more familiar with, we're a bit more comfortable with in terms of understanding the governance structures. But really, the businesses that we've deployed into, they tend to be pan-regional. You know, so they're across Southeast Asia in terms of their operations and therefore in terms of the impact that they create as well. I think the impact creation pathways for us, apart from the B Corp strategy, which is really the big overlay for us, you know, trying to make sure that there's a baseline governance standard across all the portfolio companies. We're very passionate about the environmental piece. So what we're trying to do is baseline the carbon footprint and carbon intensity of our investee companies and commit them into a low carbon transition pathway. So we want these companies to improve their carbon profiles. The other piece that my team is very passionate about as well is the social piece. So, you know, you'd probably be aware of this, but gender inequity is still a huge issue across Asia and still in Southeast Asia itself. And our goal really is to try and make our companies much more gender equitable as employers as we can, right? So, you know, I think, you know, from a broad thematic perspective, those are some of the things that we're working on at Bintang.
I love that. And we'd love to kind of maybe, if we can, like tie this into, you know, how we both define impact. And I think you gave a great example of that. And if I just could repeat that for the audience, I think what you said, it was really about the intention and the impact they want to create. And as they grow and scale their business, they solve that problem even more. From an innovative lens, right? That's what you were talking about. Additionality might be the concept that's thrown around, you know, providing something that otherwise might not be there, right? Transforming lives, impact at the end of the day. If that's the case, though, my question for you is this, is with a low carbon transition pathway or social peace and those efforts, how does that tie into I guess, scalability in solving that core issue? Or is that seen on the financial assessment as an added cost? I mean, where do you kind of factor that in into the financial assessment? Just curious to get your perspective from a banker's lens.
Yeah, sure. I think the definition that you've given for impact is really spot on. At a business level, a broad definition of impact would be making lives better through innovation and entrepreneurship, right? So I think one of the things that we are very, very aware of, we're very cognizant of right now, is the urgency of improving lives has never been higher, I think, in history, right? So the context to that really is the fact that, when I was born in 79, there were about 4 billion people living on the planet. We're now sharing the planet with about 8 billion other people, right? So in that short 4 decades that I've been alive, really the population of the Earth has doubled up. And I think a lot of the fight right now around impact is not just about improving lives, but ensuring that we can keep standards up as the pressure on resources mounts, right? And I think with that increased pressure, when we talk about phase, really was operating 4 decades ago, right? When you invest in a company today and you're looking at a business which is in Southeast Asia, and the perception globally is that there are lots of human rights issues, there are lots of social issues embedded into the structure of societies that belong to this emerging markets category, whether it's Southeast Asia or South America, Africa, wherever. I think when you think about it from a PE perspective, one of the major risks we face is exit risk. I've got to sell this business at some stage, right? I can sell it to a financial sponsor, another private equity firm. And perhaps if the business grows, it's going to be a global private equity firm, right? Like my ultimate shareholders, which is CVC Partners, global private equity franchise. I could list the company, and I may want to list it on the Malaysian stock market. I might want to list it in Singapore. I may even want to list it on NASDAQ, right? If it's a innovative technology business, right? Now, if you look at the considerations that investors have, right? Whether it's a private equity investor who's coming at it from a global lens, where he or she is starting to see a lot of pressure on things like sustainability and ESG. They're not going to pay a premium for a business where the perceived risk within that ESG space is a lot higher than a business that's based in the US or Europe that's doing the same thing. So from their capital allocation perspective, they'll say, why not I invest in a company which is in Europe or US doing exactly the same thing, maybe not growing at quite the same pace, at quite the same rate, but at least it doesn't carry that risk from an ESG perspective that could damage me, a global brand, very significantly if I were to invest in this business, right? If you think about listing a business and you look at the stock exchange rules and the standards of governance that are being applied to this part of the world, you'll find that it's rapidly catching up with European and US standards, right? So it's not getting any easier. I think the lenses to which the stock exchange regulators look at companies that are about to get on their exchanges, it's getting tougher and tougher. And ESG is a very, very big component of that now. Exit risk, if you don't look at ESG, is a lot higher, definitely even in this part of the world. And that, I think, creates a huge systemic risk or issue within the private equity investing chain, right? People say investing in a company is the easy part. Building value and exiting the business, that's a really tough part.
I really think that's interesting how when I think about, okay, if I'm going to add value to a business that I've just acquired, and with the idea to sell it soon, and you're taking them really, at a really like integrated level, and having that purpose manifest throughout all of its operations, its business, its marketing, its communications, and also Intuit's governance with getting them certified as a B Corp. I could really see the value that you're adding there and that being priced into the exit, making it an attractive investment. My question is this, though, is it's, you know, being a certified B Corp in a private market, do you see any challenges with that from taking that to a public market? I'll say the easiest one, right? Maximizing stakeholder value as opposed to maximizing shareholder value legally. So just your initial thoughts there on maybe the disparity between a private market and a public market. And do you see any, struggles with that?
Yeah. I think that's probably one of the most heated debates going around right now around the impact movement, and specifically, I think, around the B Corp movement as well. Looking at broad stakeholder value. Historically, I think a lot of the traditional company focus has been around generating maximum returns for its shareholders. I take a slightly different view, and I think those interests are really starting to converge. So if you look at corporate evolution, you go back 50, 60 years ago, when you talk about maximizing shareholder value, the historical definition of shareholder value is very, very focused around a certain group of shareholders. And usually that group would be majority or controlling shareholders, right? And it wasn't until probably in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s in the UK, when there were massive corporate scandals like Polypec, the Maxwell Group, the Mirror Group, where you have very big dominant shareholders abusing the rights of minority shareholders, which ultimately led to the Cadbury report in 1992, where they said, hey, we can't have this continue anymore. You can't be a big shareholder and abuse the minority shareholders, right? If you look at what happened in the US in the early 2000s, just as I started working, we had scandals, accounting scandals like Enron, WorldCom, MCI, big names that overnight basically just collapsed. And then it went from sort of like, protecting institutional shareholders, both majority, minority institutional shareholders, to protecting retail shareholders as well, right? And the broader impact, any corporate collapse, systemic impact a corporate collapse would have on society as a whole. It's not stuck in just focusing around shareholders anymore. You start seeing a lot of policy creep coming into, how companies operate, because there is this broad realization that you can't have companies abusing other stakeholders that are not financial stakeholders of the business, right? As the world's population increases and it gets closer to, we're going to end up in a situation where everyone is, in inverted commas, a stakeholder or an investor, a shareholder in all the businesses, that are, on this planet.
And that was certainly a theme that's going on right now. I can say with a lot of the CEOs that we have in our community, they're trying to think about, which is why I commend you for what you're doing, and they're looking for values aligned, private equity organizations that can help either take them to the next level or however they define success. I mean, this is their life's work that they're putting into. Another common theme I'm hearing a lot is transitioning into a perpetual purpose fund or trust, more so, and going into employee ownership. How does that have you come across that in your line of work, and has that impacted maybe working with a company if they were to go into an employee-owned trust or an employee-owned organization?
I think that's the aspiration for lots of businesses that we look at. A lot of the founders that we talk to already are looking at employee share ownership, through either ESOP schemes or, something similar to that, right? They want a lot more engagement, I think, with their worker base. I think that creates a very different level of purpose within the organization when everyone's sort of feeling like they own the business, they're part owners of the business as well. I think evolutionary, from an evolutionary perspective, you know, what you described is probably a little bit into the future, but I think it's going to be very mainstream, you know, in the next 10 to 20 years. I think the challenges that we deal with right now with the workforce is that, you know, getting buy-in is really, really in companies in the corporate world has declined, I think, very dramatically. If we think back to our fathers or grandfathers' eras, as later, that's very, very rare these days, right? So people move around quite a bit. And I think, you know, the transitionary nature of the workforce is partly because a lot of people struggle to find purpose in the work that they're doing. And founders, you know, really struggle to try and bring purpose to the table when it comes to people that work for them in their organization, right? I'm not saying that employee share ownership will solve that problem, but I think it would probably be a great sign if people employed in a business voluntarily end up acquiring equity in that business. I think that shows a huge amount of buy-in for what the business is doing, right? So that's kind of our thought process. We encourage founders to think about equity allocations to staff. I think we're trying to see if we can push the envelope a little bit, because the trend is that it's just the management lineup that have got equity in the business. We're trying to see if, you know, it's possible to get more rank and file workers also to be equity owners in the business. A trend moving in that direction.
I think that's awesome. I'm glad you're helping them, like you're working with them to do that, or at least explore that. Would just a simple question though, would that add or subtract value in Anexo, or would it really just depend on kind of the legacy of the company and how it's been performing?
I think it's time frames again, right? So if you're looking at a very short time frame, you know, I think the consensus would be that it's a cost. It will detract equity value from, you know, other shareholders in the business. But I mean, if you think about the longer term effect, and by having a more bought in workforce, workforce that's actually more excited about the business, that feels a sense of buy in and ownership in the business, I would argue that if you look at probably a 5-6 year period post, you know, putting such a scheme in place, you'd probably see higher levels of accountability. Which would probably drive things like efficiency, which would probably drive, you know, the growth of the business as well. You would convert people that work for you in the business into promoters of the business, right? Because they would go out there and they would see that direct linkage between what they do and their equity value, their personal equity value. So, you know, I think that's a huge competitive advantage, a huge differentiating factor for companies in the 21st century, right? You don't see that level of buy-in very often.
Yeah, and I've looked into it a few times and spoke to a few CEOs, and they're saying very similar things. I mean, of course, there, but it is interesting. I mean, I'd be curious to learn kind of how that plays out over time, especially if the founder's gone. Anyway, it's a case by case scenario, like it is with anything. But of course, you could clearly see how that would retain an employee, especially in a local economy. Johan, this has been a fun conversation today. I think an overarching theme might be around just the question I'm asking you next, which is, what do you think the purpose of a business is?
I think the purpose of a business is to serve a relevance in society, right? I think the day that you lose that relevance is the day that, you know, you lose buy-in to your brand, you lose customers, you lose revenue, and ultimately, you know, you can't sustain yourself as a commercial entity. You lose profit, right? So, you know, I think we work with a lot of founder-led businesses, so we're not dealing with businesses that have crossed that threshold into effectively institutionalization, right? So we're dealing with a lot of mid-market style companies. And I find that the purpose of the entrepreneur, the founder that drives the business, and there are lots of different purposes that entrepreneurs have, right? When they build a business. I mean, some have a very selfless motive. As I described earlier, they want to solve a societal problem. Others could have a more personal reason where, you know, they want to give their families a better life. And who's to say that's not a great impact to have, right? And in my experience, I've seen entrepreneurs who have lost that sense of purpose. And once they lose that purpose, the business follows suit, right? So, you know, the companies become less relevant, they become less loved. Ultimately, they make less or worse yet negative profits as well, right? Now, I think it's very normal. You know, you and I have probably been through this enough times, but in life, I think you do end up losing your sense of purpose once in a while. That's no different, I think, for companies as well. Things change, right? The markets change, the world moves on. And I think it's the message is really that it's okay for businesses and for founders to pause, think, and ultimately come up with a new purpose if they've lost their way, right? So I think that's really, really key for me. We do ask that question quite a lot. When we talk to founders, we say, you know, why did you build this company in the first place? And then the very natural follow-on question is your purpose today the same as the sense of purpose that you had when you founded the business 5-10 years ago, right? Or has something changed? For us, I think that's a very, very important question. You've hit the nail on the head again. Purpose is really the key thing for us.
I love that. And you know, one of the ways I like to think about it, and I speak with just CEOs, and I guess in my experience, the things that like resonates with them is it's really your North Star, right? It's really your North Star. And if you even take just like the slightest turn, if you're a boat traveling to that North Star, you take the slightest turn, you know, over, you know, minutes, days, years, you're going to be on a completely different trajectory than when you started out. So I love the idea of a purpose. I love it realigning that. Our assumptions are always challenged, especially in difficult markets. And that is the crux of why it's so unique, I believe, to be a purpose-driven, impact-oriented CEO is when it comes down to a difficult market and the customer is changing, you know, what do you do, right? So it's a really interesting topic. Now, with the titans, the greats that you've worked with, what do you think like the through line is for those individuals, the founders, the ones that kind of pop into your head, like from a leadership point of view, like what do you think the through line is between all of them?
I think the guys who have done really, really well with their businesses, the common threads, I mean, the obvious one to me is a very, very clear sense of purpose. They never struggle when asked the question around purpose, right? The clarity is a completely different level. That's always jumped across the page for me, right? The other thing is a lot of them, you know, they're realists, I guess, in the way they execute their businesses. But a lot of them are very positive, quite optimistic people. And I guess if you're a founder, you probably have to be a bit of an unfettered optimist in some ways, right? You've got to have self-belief, I guess, in terms of what you're trying to build, as well as the purpose of the business as well. Most of the guys I've known, I mean, there are very, very few exceptions to this rule. They're just incredibly hardworking people. They're not afraid of putting in the hours. They realize that there's a sacrifice in terms of building something different, building something great. And the other thing that really jumps out to me is, in that sacrifice that they're making, they don't see it as a sacrifice. A lot of them are actually really, really enjoying what they do as well. And that joy, that passion, that energy they have is pretty infectious. I mean, it's obviously infectious to their teams. I've dealt with a few of these guys, even outside the remit of Bintang's investments in my personal capacity. But it's amazing how much they enjoy their work, and then how much their teams tend to enjoy the work because the founder enjoys the work, right? So I'm not sure whether it's echo chambering and they just attract people who are very similar to them in that regard, or who are driven by the same things as they are. But it's pretty telling. Now I think a lot of people forget that, you know, companies, businesses, it's not one person. Not one guy or one gal, right? It's a whole team. And I think finding people actually that are naturally passionate about the same things. I think that's super, super important. So those are a few themes I think that I see, the common threads that I see with a lot of the business greats that I've had the pleasure of actually working with.
I love that.
It's magical.
There is magic. And it seems like a lot of heart too in the businesses that they're running. What about the head though? What about the weaknesses perhaps that you would say that not necessarily the Titans, the people you just described, but where you've seen leaders struggle?
I think there's a saying, failure is a great mentor for life, but success is one of the worst mentors for life, right? And I think what tends to happen is you get founders who've done really, really well building one thing. And because of that, they feel they can do no wrong, right? So, I think it creates a mindset where I've done really well and I've been able to build something, and it's a good thing, it's a great thing. But I can therefore walk on water, and I will do no wrong in anything else that I do, right? I hesitate to use the word arrogance, because I mean, sometimes it's not really born of arrogance. It's just maybe overconfidence of being able to replicate that success elsewhere, right? So, what we like, I guess, taking a twist to that question, is finding founders who are quite scrappy, where, they've had a few knocks in life. I've lost parents. They've been orphaned at a very young age. Their families have had to struggle economically. Life has been a struggle in some way or another for them. Or they've even founded businesses where the businesses haven't taken off, and they've had to reset, right? They've had to really think about where they came from, where they went wrong, what they did wrong, and then have to rethink they have to rebuild themselves effectively, right? And I think that humility of being able to do that is really, really key.
I've been like so, you can't see my face right now, but I've been so focused on how to destroy the ego recently that it's, I've become almost obsessed with it. I've really felt that. I took a 4-month hiatus from this podcast that I was sharing with you earlier because I think the ego got to me. I think the decisions I started to make were poor, were miscalculated, were short-sighted. And acknowledging that and trying to see that, ego may give you confidence, but it is a fake confidence. And in fact, you think of, the most egotistical people in the world, sure, they might be successful, but really their best art, their best performance, their best work came from times of what you just mentioned, rebuilding themselves, when they were humiliated, when they were humble. And so that's just something like I'm just always fascinated about. And I'm interested. I love that you picked up on that, that you acknowledge that, on the way to ascent, it can be your biggest downfall. So I appreciate you, you kind of diving into that today. Johan, this has been a really fun conversation. Let's bring this home. In all of this, what is your definition of a real leader?
I think leadership is really about service. It's not about title. It's not about position. People conflate those elements and think that that's leadership. It's really not. I think a very important key part of service is being useful. It's always been my aspiration to be as useful to as many people as possible for as long as possible, even if I'm not in a position of leadership, right? I love this quote by one of your founding fathers, actually, John Quincy Adams, right? The son of John Adams. He said, if your actions inspire others to dream more, to learn more, to do more and become more, you are a leader, right? So it's really a lovely definition, because it's not about the person, it's about the other people around the person. Right. And I think you can't be a true leader if others don't see you as a leader. Right. So it's a lot about your action It's a lot about how you change their lives. It's not about how you change your lives, your own life. Yeah.
Well said for Johan Rosali. Well, Tooth, I'm Kevin Edwards asking you to go out there, inspire others to take action, and always keep it real. Thanks, Johan.
Thanks, Kevin.
Hey, Relators, thanks again for listening to this amazing episode. And if you're someone like me who goes all the way to the end just to make sure I can extract as much information, education, and inspiration out of every single interview, might I suggest you check out our magazine. If you go online to Relators.com today, you're going to get the first 30 days for free, where you're going to be able to access all of our magazines, courses, and live events from some of the top thought leaders around the world. All you have to do is go online to realleaders.com and click the subscribe button in the top right corner to get your free 30-day trial right now. Again, that's real-leaders.com. Thanks again for being a real leader, and always keep it real.